I'm Michael J. Long. It is January 12th, 2019. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate it. We have a special guest. His name, Alex Merced. He's the vice chairman of the National Libertarian Party, who also ran for the Senate back in, what was it, 2016?
That's correct.
And I guess we could talk about taxes and health care. Does that sound like a plan?
Sounds good. Which one would you like to talk about first, Michael?
Well, let's see if we could talk about health care and see how that affects people and the differences between what your solutions would be and what the status quo solutions are.
Gotcha. Okay, so basically, healthcare is definitely one of the most difficult issues to talk about because it's distorted in so many different ways. So I'll start off by just saying this. First, I just want to say thank you for having me, Michael. It's been a long time since I've gotten to see you, so it's lovely to be able to talk to you again. But on healthcare, usually the way I start out is I'll give my brief summary, but everyone who wants to really understand the healthcare issue in and out, they really need to read the book, The Primal Prescription, by Robert Murphy and Doug McGough. Basically, they do a great job of kind of going into the history of a lot of the regulations that shape the industry where it is today here in the U.S. and whatnot. But basically, really to understand healthcare, the U.S. system of healthcare is very unique versus a lot of the rest of the world. And there's a reason for that. It all kind of starts off with like going back to World War II, where basically there was a lot of controls on wages as far as like how much I can pay my employees. So basically, when people were trying to find ways to incentivize employees to work for them, they had to find other things to give them other than just, you know, more pay. So basically, they started paying for their health care, started paying, giving them money for retirement. And so basically, more and more of these things became tied and tied to your employer. And that sounds nice when you have a job and they pay for your health care, but this creates a very unique situation. Now, when it comes to the health care company, well, it basically changes how you pay for the doctor, okay? So, for example, nowadays what happens is that I go to work, my employer provides me for my health care, so my employer is the one paying the health care company a good chunk of the premium. So at the end of the day, companies design their product for who's paying. At the end of the day, the customer is whoever is paying. So I may be the person getting the health care services, but I'm not the customer of the health insurance company. My employer is. So then what happens is that they're going to design a product that caters to what the employer's needs are, which are not the same as my own healthcare needs. At the same time, the doctor or the medical professional that I go to, well, who's paying them is primarily the insurance company. So their practice is not necessarily is built around giving me the best experience possible. This is why you have long wait times, and sometimes doctors are very short with you because their goal is to do what they need to do, build the insurance company, and basically build their practice so that way the insurance company will pay them. So it becomes less about providing me with service and quality service, even though a lot of doctors try to do the best to take care of their patients. It becomes this huge issue of getting paid by the insurance companies, because at the end of the day, that's really their customer. Okay, I've had medical professionals who I had a great rapport with. I was very glad with them. And then basically I could no longer go to them anymore because they no longer took my insurance. Because it's not me who's paying, it's the insurance who's paying. So basically, by severing the relationship between the direct medical professional and the consumer, the person who's actually getting the medical services, there's this huge one deterioration of transparency, deterioration of quality of service, and which also has impact on health outcomes. And what happens is that people get tied to their employers. They're stuck at their employer because that's who's providing their health care. So basically, they lose their job. Anything happens, they end up with a huge debt. So you have this big severing. And that's because of all these regulations and changes in the tax code over the years. So what libertarians are oftentimes advocating for is basically getting rid of those middlemen, saying, hey, you know what? My health insurance doesn't necessarily have to be the direct payer of my health care. This is why a lot of libertarians are for like direct primary care, where you are paying a monthly fee for a group of medical services, and then you are the customer. They're catering to you. And then two, that the health insurance company shouldn't have to be paid by your employer, because then again, then they're not catering to you. And that's naturally what will probably happen if there wasn't so many regulations and tax incentives over the years that have kind of distorted the system into this direction. And also with these simple reforms that allow people to do sort of group and association type purchasing of healthcare services, not just healthcare insurance, but healthcare services directly, you can really kind of open it up where you can have that connection again. So basically the individual who's getting healthcare services, whose life is on the line, is the customer once again. A lot of people want to just switch out the insurance and the employer with the government as the provider of your healthcare insurance, but then again, you're not the customer. Then the doctor's practice is built around what the government wants in order to pay, which is going to be at the whims of who's politically in charge, instead of at the end of the day, what do I need right now? So at the end of the day, you want a healthcare system that's built around what the patient needs right now. The patient needs to be the center of having the agency on who gets paid. And then that's sort of the economics behind it. And then from a libertarian standpoint, there's market forces that breed innovation, lower cost, and all that stuff. So that's the long and short of healthcare. There's not really a good, concise argument for healthcare, which makes it a very difficult issue to talk about because there's so many layers of bureaucracy on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I noticed too, like, there's all these private insurance, and then you have Medicare and Medicaid. And, you know, I've been dependent on Medicare, and there are legitimate people who need Medicare and Medicaid and all that. And I don't think we libertarians are trying to advocate for getting rid of, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security overnight, or let alone, you know, but what we are pushing for is to see, okay, how much privatization can we offer? How much more free markets can we include in the process? And, you know, whatever services we still have on the government level to give it to people who truly need it, which is, like you said, is more difficult than usual because you've got other people that will take advantage of it. So, but, you know, there are various different solutions. There's the idea that, and there's an idea that I was trying to promote where by Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid should compete with the free market, and there should be more choices between the free market and the individuals. And, you know, but like you got people with autism, and, you know, I'm not trying to, I mean, that might, or, you know, even the parents, they might come up and say, well, why do you want to get rid of Social Security? But I don't think that's at the heart of the argument. I think what's at the heart of the argument is, you know, what can we do to reduce the size and the power and the spending of the government? Wouldn't you agree?
I agree. Let me take a page out of Larry Sharpe's book and say, let's take it one step further. It's not even about reducing the size of government. It's about providing people with the best options possible. And the problem is that when government gets larger, it sometimes gets in the way of more options being available. So there are, I'll talk about some ways that you could privatize some of those things in government without necessarily providing anybody with less services. And then two, again, with sort of less, when government is providing something, especially when government is doing everything, they're going to use the power to kind of protect their position in that space. And that's where it always becomes a problem. The government says they want to jump into an industry to help, and maybe initially they do. But over time, they end up forcing out all the competition because they have a vested interest in having more and more market share because it helps them with their funding of that. But, I mean, one thing you could do, you don't have to eliminate Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. These things can be privatized. And I know privatized is oftentimes a very scary word for people because what they imagine is that we're just going to go out there and say, hey, here's this thing. Whoever wants to pay the most money for it gets it, and then the person who gets it turns it to something completely different that doesn't help people in the same way as it does before. But one of the mm-hmm. things is that selling something doesn't have to be done that way. In a free market, you can enter any arrangement you want. You can enter a sale with restrictions. If I want to sell my house, I can sit there and say, hey, you buy my house, you have to sign a contract saying you won't renovate the house for 10 years. I can do that. So in the same way, the government can divest itself of many of its programs, but then still keep those programs in place. So for example, I mean, earlier in a live stream I did earlier, I was talking about this relative to government parks. But you can essentially apply the same logic to Medicaid or Medicare. You could sit there and say, hey, you know what? We're going to take Medicaid and Medicare and spin it off into a private corporation. And the way we're going to raise money for it is by we're going to sell shares in that corporation. But anyone who buys shares, that share is going to have a negative dividend, basically a tax. But you choose to pay it. If you don't want to pay this tax, then you don't buy a share in the corporation. But if you do, one, you can benefit from the services that it provides, and two, you have voting ability. So basically, those who would like to have the ability to have Medicare and Medicaid as an option can buy shares in Medicare and Medicaid. Every year, they may have to pay 12, 20, 30, 40 bucks, depending on how many shares they buy. But also, those shares allow them to vote on who's in charge, allow them to provide oversight over that agency, and now that thing is separated from the rest of government. And now when government shuts down, you're not worried about whether Medicaid or Medicare is functioning, because it has nothing to do with the rest of government. It's now its own separate thing. So you can still provide those services, and since the shareholders would be people who are invested in keeping it the way it is, it can still provide the services that it's providing people, et cetera. And again, you don't have to limit the use to shareholders. You can structure that any way you want. But there are, and you can limit how many shares people can buy, so that way nobody has individually sort of complete control over it. So you can do sort of a limited IPO and create like a negative dividend to fund it. And again, a limited IPO to make sure you spread the governance around. And now you've shifted it into private hands without necessarily making it this thing that people are just going to strip for profit. And I think that's something that could be, that's a model that could be applied to literally anything in government, national parks, healthcare agencies, education agencies, literally anything can be spun off. And it's better because when that king operates independently and doesn't have to worry, if the education people don't have to worry about the politics of healthcare and the healthcare people don't have to worry about the politics of war, you'll have better governance. And then with the negative dividend, you'll have voluntary funding. But you'll still not you'll still necessarily have all the pieces that people want. And if there's pieces of government that people aren't willing to enter this kind of arrangement for, then probably they didn't really value it in the first place. But at the end of the day, that's just one option, to take what's currently existing and shift it into a more libertarian model. But at the same time, with a more free market, new models will exist. And also, in a free market with less taxes, less regulation, there'll be more opportunities and more economic prosperity, that people can afford to be more charitable, that there will be all sorts of models that, one, there'll be cheaper models, that way more people can afford it, so less people may need help, and then those who need help will much more easily be able to find aid because there'll be more of it available. Because right now, taxes eat up so much of our paycheck. And because government's involvement in healthcare has gotten so expensive, that eats up a lot of our paycheck. With government's involved in housing, housing's gotten so expensive that it eats up most of our paycheck. So we have no paycheck left to, one, afford anything for ourselves, and two, much less give a charitable hand to others. But that's because of government's involvement in the prices of things from their policies. But if you can roll that back, you can free up people's paychecks so that way they can live better lives, lead, and one, need less help and give more help. And then two, and then again, you can spin off the existing services that government has into independent bodies, so that way those services don't necessarily end, but they can still be independently funded, independently governed. So, I think there are solutions out there, and privatization doesn't have to be a scary word if people realize that privatization doesn't have to just work one way.
Right. There's another possible solution that I think is out there, and that is, we could privatize Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, and we could also fund it through private contributions or fund it through private contributions. So how would that work? Let's say we decided not to privatize Social Security, but we decided it was going to be funded through private contributions and they were going to compete with the free market. How would that be any more or any less successful than privatization, or what?
Well, I mean, one thing I have thought about, it's sort of a midway point, especially with specifically with Social Security, is you're giving people some more options. So right now, your money goes into Social Security and it goes into one trust fund. And that trust fund, all it does is buy government bonds. So essentially, the government takes your money and then lends it to itself. But what if you have more options? So basically, a lot of people are very scared of privatizing Social Security and then just saying, hey, we're going to just let you go put your money in the market. Because a lot of people may not feel very comfortable putting their money in the market, and that's fair. So how about giving them at least a couple options? So that way those who would like to put their money in the market have that option, and then a couple other tiered options. So my basic model for the sort of very timid reform would be people would still basically have their money taken out for Social Security, this is again a compromise solution. But you'd have three choices. The first choice would be traditional Social Security, but probably with a higher age, retirement age, so that way it's financially feasible. Two, you could either go in the middle one choice would be your money would be invested in a fund that buys municipal bonds. Now, for those who are not familiar with what are municipal bonds, they're bonds for states, towns, counties. So this fund would invest in very specific types of municipal bonds that are meant to be bought by this fund that fund like capital projects. So they'll fund, these are bonds to build roads, infrastructure. So then people's money will go into this fund and they'll buy bonds from different states who have different infrastructure projects. And you're going to get a much higher return on those bonds than you would they work it out so that way it has a good yield. So basically, the income would probably be tax-free for investing in this fund because it's municipal debt. So in that case, your overall return should be equivalent or better than a treasury. They would design it specifically for that. So you have a little bit higher return in this fund, but then you're also funding infrastructure projects across the country for those who care about that. So they get this middle solution. You're getting a little bit more return. There's a little bit of risk because municipal bonds aren't 100% safe. And then the third option would be something more structured like an equity index and annuity. Now, in this case, what happens is that usually you would have like a bank or a financial institution or an insurance company, and they would guarantee you that your account will grow by the same value as the market. And basically the risk is on the insurance company because they promise you the growth. So if the market's up 10%, you get 10%, but if the market's down, you don't lose anything because they generally set a floor and a max. So say, hey, if the market goes up to 10%, you can get up to 10% this year. But if it goes down 10, you get zero, which is still better than losing money. So you get the upside of the good years of the market without the downside. And doing that kind of a structure at the scale of a Social Security would, one, again, put money in the private market. All that money that's sitting in the Social Security Trust Fund, putting it in the private market so that way it can help the economy, but minimize the risk that the individual people who are putting the money in there are really exposed to. And unlike just buying an individual equity index annuity where the fees might be kind of high, doing it on that scale could make the fees very reasonable, where it makes it a very attractive method of investing your money. And this is something that they're kind of doing in Galveston, Texas. They've actually opted out of Social Security and you get put into a program like this. But again, the idea is you have a choice. If you want traditional Social Security, you get it. If you want to kind of fund infrastructure and get that sort of middle of the road program, you can do that. And if you want to have your money going out and helping the private economy and create jobs and do all that cool stuff, you can do the third option. So this would be sort of a middle of the road option. And if it works and people like it, then we can do more free market reforms later on.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are your overall views on taxes? Because I know, like, there's been various proposals, including the fair tax, but I kind of agree that the current tax system that we have is failing us, and most people are having to pay high taxes. So what's your overall view on that in terms of taxes?
I want less taxes. I want less all taxes. I want less income taxes. I want less property taxes. I want less sales taxes. I want less taxes across the board. And people don't realize how many individual taxes we pay. People always just focus around the income tax. They don't realize that, I mean, when you live in like New York, you're paying taxes on everything. You're paying your income tax federally, you're paying a high income tax statewide, you're paying a high sales tax statewide, you're paying high property taxes. I mean, across the board, New York has some of the highest taxes. So it hits you over and over and over again. And you end up being a lot. And then the thing is that those taxes then transfer into the cost of where you live, the cost of what you buy. So then you're also paying more for everything because everybody else is recouping their tax expense and how what they charge you. So basically, it just attacks you from all sides. And it's very pernicious. It's very hard. Life is hard in New York. that's the reason why so many people are leaving New York every year. But the thing is, so I want less taxes. Now, that can be done in different ways. I mean, well, that's one side of the coin. The other thing I want is a simpler tax code. If we're going to have a tax system, which I, of course, I'd rather be able to spin everything in government into those sort of independent bodies, like I said before, with a negative dividend, so people can choose to fund them by buying shares in these independent bodies and being involved directly in their governance. I think that's a model where you kind of privatize pretty much all of the government's functions with the minimum, but still kind of retain something that's very much like the government is now, but in a much more free market sense. But if you're going to have a tax system, I want something that's simple, something that's easy, because where a lot of corruption happens is in the complexity of the rules. People make rules complicated so that way other people don't know you're breaking the rules. Or people don't realize they are breaking the rules because the rules are so complicated, and then basically when the government sees them as a threat, can just say, hey, you broke this rule, and can shut them up. So that complexity hurts people, can be used to silence people, and it can also be used to get around oversight. So I would want the tax code to become a lot simpler than the spaghetti, overly complex tax code we have now. That means the people who don't understand it end up getting penalized for not understanding it and paying a lot more taxes than they could. And then those who spend the time to hire the right accountants and the right lawyers pay a lot less just because they were able to either have the brain trust or pay for the brain trust to pay less taxes. That's not really a fair system. So you want something that's simple that everybody can appreciate. So I want a simpler tax code, but ideally I would want less of a tax code, ideally no tax code, everything funded through sort of a voluntary segmentation, as I discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense because, I mean, we have way too much government. I mean, we have the FBI, we have the NSA, the CIA, the ATF. We have a lot of government agencies that should be abolished. And then we have a lot of other government agencies, and there are some government agencies we could privatize. I mean, my main emphasis for Social Security, like Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, CHIPS, and all that, I would probably try and get them to compete with the free market or privatize them and have people pay for it through private contributions. But then you have all these other government agencies. I've thought about, you know, too, why don't we also privatize the National Weather Service and, you know, the VA, because the VA is going broke, and with all these veterans and stuff that they keep getting. You know, it seems like every time we have more government, we have less freedom, and we have more corruption and more power given to the government. And we're less free as a result. All right, so, like, there are government agencies, I don't know if that was picked up in the recording or not, where that should be privatized or at least made to compete with the free market and be funded through private contributions like the Medicaid, the Medicare, the CHIPS, and the Social Security, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have all these other government agencies that, like, I've thought about, like, privatizing the National Weather Service, the VA, and, like you mentioned, these federal government parks and recreation places. I have no problem privatizing any of that. But I think all these other government agencies that we don't need, like the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, should probably be abolished. But, again,
in my heart of hearts, I 100% agree with you. From the flip standpoint, it's really hard to just end things for a lot of agencies. But what you can do is, with those privatization schemes, you can limit their scope. To make sure that they can do the things that people do care about them doing. But basically, by privatizing them the way I outlined, one, you can use the investment banks to help you actually seek those shareholders out and do an IPO that'll find the right shareholders that basically they have the infrastructure to scale to actually get that done. But two, if these agencies, by having direct oversight by shareholders who care, these agencies can change in scope and also will have the kind of oversight and transparency that will keep them from doing a lot of the most pernicious things that they do right now, and also kind of limit their scope into sort of more free market, within the same kind of private property, free market boundaries that the rest of us live by. So, yes, I agree with you. I mean, there's a lot of things that that the government is doing that should exist, and a lot of things that the government is doing that shouldn't exist, that can exist as independent private bodies. And, you know, by just making all of it into independent private bodies, you can then just see what sticks around and what doesn't. And then you'll kind of magically find out what's needed and what's not by letting the market decide.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this leads to me to my final question, and that is, immigration's been a hot button since Trump took office. And there's a lot of people on the right that are saying, build that wall, build that wall. And my emphasis on it is that, look, the wall along the U.S.-Mexican border isn't going to work, because even if you manage to artificially reduce the flow of illegal immigration, you know, there's a cost. They're going to find other ways to come in, and you're going to gradually increase the flow of illegal immigration over a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, building the wall, to me, is the wrong solution and looking at the problem in the wrong way. So basically, now one, I mean, yes, there are illegal border crossings, but generally they're at low historical lows and declining. But that doesn't mean that there isn't people who have trouble. I mean, basically it goes both ways. You have people who are doing border crossings who die in the process. Or you have people who want to immigrate who die in the process of going through a coyote and digging through tunnels or going over land. And but on the same side, you have people who live on the border who, you know, have people who might get on their property and then ends up in confrontations where people on both sides lose their lives. So there is, but that the problem isn't that there's border crossing. The problem is that there's a black market, because that's what it is. It's a prohibition, and we have an immigration system that when there's such a demand for immigration to the U.S., to have a system that isn't as streamlined as ours, it creates there's an excess demand, and that an excess demand always creates a black market. But you don't have to make something illegal for there to be a black market. Like, take a look at cigarettes in New York City. New York City just taxes them way too much, so people sell loose cigarettes here and there because it's just cheaper to buy the cigarettes in Jersey and then go sell them to New Yorkers under the table. When you make something, when you restrict or make something prohibitively to attain, you create black markets. And that's what immigration is. So all this undocumented immigration is essentially a black market immigration that creates the violence, that creates the crime, that people are worried about. But the solution to black markets isn't to just have stricter enforcement. It didn't work with drugs, okay? You can fund the DEA as much as you want. The drug war, the negative effects of prohibition and black markets just kept getting worse and worse and worse. You can have all the enforcement and immigration. Things will only get better when we address the underlying problem, which is the provision of a formal and legal process for immigration. We need to address the prohibition aspect instead of just addressing the enforcement aspect. People always just think we just need to punish more, you just need to punish more, and things will go away. But one thing we keep seeing in life is that the more you punish people, the more they push back, and you actually end up making the problem worse. Okay, I mean, you're seeing this now in the prison system, where there's prisons in other countries that actually, instead of trying to create a prison that's rough and tough on prisoners, they create prisons that are actually more like living in the real world. You can't leave. It's like living in the real world, so that way when they leave, they can function in the real world, okay? Because people learn to live in the world that they're modeling, in the world that they exist in. So we have a prison which is basically a cage. People learn how to live and behave like they live in a cage. So then when they're released, they don't know how to function in the real world. So you end up getting worse outcomes, and you're just punishing people for the sake of punishment. So we need to change our mindset from looking for solutions instead of just looking to punish people who do things we don't like. And that's how I feel about immigration. That's how I feel about the drug laws, how I feel about criminal justice. It's just sort of my perspective on most issues. So that would be my take on that.
Right. And I think that could be applied to just about any issue. The more rules and regulations you have on the government level, you're going to have more bureaucracy, and it reduces the amount of freedom and choices that individuals have.
Agreed.
So anyways, we're just about out of time. Are there any last words you'd like to say?
I would like to say thank you very I would like to say thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure being on. And for anyone who would like to know more about me, go to my website, alexmissa.com. I just redid it, so it's all different. It'll be much easier for you to find the information you need now at alexmerced.com. And follow me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, anywhere that's social media, I'm there.
All right. Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me. I appreciate it. Alex, it was a pleasure doing the podcast with you.
Thank you very much.